Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And the whole point of doing all of this, especially going through these final documents, is to help you understand how important it is to obtain constitutional compliance. And the faster we get people to have this, quote-unquote, buy-in, in other words, getting you sold on this, I'll just say, this divine effort, if we actually get our public servants to fully comply to the Constitution and getting rid of all things that they have no authority to do, this would completely turn this country around. That debt would go away. Our taxation, our inflation would literally go away, because now the federal government isn't throwing trillions of dollars out to a felonious debt. And they're not doing all of the spending, so they're not taxing us as much. They'll be able to reduce the currency in circulation, which will help reduce the inflation, which basically inflation is more currency in circulation. And actually, as we start undoing all of the labor laws and labor regulations, all these things are unconstitutional, getting rid of minimum wage, we now actually free laborers to be able to at least go and get a job into an entry-level position that would actually take them somewhere or prepare them for something more, instead of, you know, finding jobs going away because robotics is a lot cheaper than paying people $20 an hour. Anyway, especially if it's fundamental, you know, pulling weeds, a person doesn't need nor do they deserve $20 an hour. It is what it is, though, because if it requires education, if it requires skill, then that's what drives the price of labor up. If it requires no education, no skill, like pulling weeds, other than the fact that you don't want to have them pulling up good plants, they at least need to know what a weed is. But anyway, I mean, we're not talking rocket science, but the point is that as we understand these things, we can actually start restoring our government and getting back to the framework of the Constitution. Because currently, right now, does anybody know? And welcome back, Tammy, and welcome back, Sean. Both of you. This is your cue and opportunity to check mutes and so forth. But does either of you know what the current price of silver is? Per ounce, but what silver is going 4, for?
4,000 and something.
No, that's gold. That's gold.
Oh, that's gold.
Yeah.
Silver.
Okay, so gold is.
Well, let me look it up.
It's 4,200. Silver is pushing $60.
57.26.
Yeah, I got the live ticker telling me it's 58.25, but whatever, it doesn't matter. What matters, because I've gone on Monex, and I don't know how accurate their feed is, but what matters is when Biden took office and we started warning you about the digital currency and how these commodities are going to become a high demand, it took a long time for people to start seeing the real threat, where people started moving in and buying. Now you're actually seeing it. So when I started warning people, when, if I remember correctly, it was like $16 an ounce. And I said, within the next few years, these things are going to skyrocket. It's not going to happen tomorrow. I actually thought you'd probably see an uptick. And we did see an uptick. We saw, you know, up to $20, 20 some dollars, something like that. But it wasn't as significant as I thought it would be. And I go, huh. Well, I guess you have some more time, but now look at what's happening. This is all based on both the inflation of both currency and the inflation of wages. This is an indictment that our society is now running away regarding inflation-wise. It's just, it's going mad. What that means is around the corner, there are going to be obscene prices for basic staples. A loaf of bread may cost you $20. Folks, you better go and start looking at where you can get grain at a very cheap price. And I even told you back in those days, you know, a good resource for getting grain, whole grain in quantities and so forth. And I think it's called Honey Grain. I think that's what it's called. Honey Grain, are these the guys? No, this is not the guys. I will look it up when we have a break, folks, because I want to remind you, these people will sell you grain, like whole grain, whole wheat, oats, what have you, either in cans that are already packed and reserved with oxygen eaters and all that stuff, or you can buy it by a 100-pound bag, 50-pound bag, what have you, and you can buy a pallet of it, and they used to sell the shipping for like $6.95. Shipped to your door. Flat shipping rate. The big, huge truck would pull up to your house, and the pallet would come off the truck, and all the stuff on the pallet is what you just paid for. And we're talking about a decent amount of food. Decent amount of food for a decent price. So, anyway, it's not, you know, things may seem better, but I'm telling you, the Bible says it's going to get really bad and really ugly. Really bad, really ugly. So let's start putting our heads together and start mitigating risks, because that's what smart people do. Anyway, we are covering the Kentucky resolutions. And if I remember correctly, Tammy basically covered up, or not covered up, she covered Resolution 6. Resolution 6 is where they really went into this idea that the president would be able to now remove a person instead of that person being removed by the court. Now, I think yesterday I mentioned that GR was wrong regarding due process, that if you're a non-citizen and you're here illegally, you do not have due process. I kind of boilerplated that you had to be a citizen to have due process. But technically, those people who are here legitimately because they instigated or they initiated an agreement to be a citizen by filing for immigration papers, and the government has come back and said, we will allow you to migrate and you have this many years to be able to become a citizen. If you don't, then we send you back. So, I mean, I don't know if that 7 years, something like that, whatever that is. But in this resolution, it basically kind of identifies the fact that, and Thomas Jefferson points out, that these people that have immigrated here do have a right, and it's a right not to the federal government, it's a right to the state to determine whether that person is no longer, you know, within the bounds of their immigration agreement or not. It's not left up to the president. And that's what this one law of the Alien and Sedition Acts did, was giving the president the power to determine this, basically with a pen. And in other words, this kind of highlights a few of the paradigms that we've had where the president is acting like he has these powers. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. So in talking about citizenship and everything else, Sean, was there any go-backs or anything that you remember from yesterday? Because you had to run into the woods and save, you know, some, I don't know, Hansel and Gretel from the witch. I'm just trying to make something up. But anyway, it doesn't matter. We're glad to have you back. And so, was there any go back on the content that we covered? Because we were going into break, and I told you I'd give you a chance when we came back from the break on those things that were gnawing at you. Yes, is it still gnawing at you, or is it all kind of fleeted, gone, and let's move on?
I'm sure it's gnawing at me off in the corner in the dark somewhere, but
okay.
It's not top of mind.
You know what? You'll have another chance. Tammy, when we were closing out the show, we were kind of talking about this resolution. We were talking about the immigration due process and so forth. And you kind of ran out of time where there wasn't enough time. Anything that was not at you that you want to bring up to say, oh, yeah, what about this? Because I think we were kind of clarifying, because you pointed out that a person could easily game the system if the states were in charge unless they had very well-defined processes to keep that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything more than that?
Yeah, because I was just wondering, I mean, they could easily come into, I mean, if they were working with Wyoming, to come in and migrate to Wyoming. I mean, as soon as they land in Boston or Denver, like, what's to prevent them from just going anywhere? So.
Right. Now, one of the things that I would encourage states, now this is something because we have to start looking forward of what is a good strategy in getting people to actually come to America. And I would actually state that when we look at all of the land that the federal government has consumed and all of the land that foreign governments have consumed, in other words, all that land is going to end up coming back to the states because that's all happened unconstitutionally. There are other lands that have been purchased by people that do not live in your state that have purchased that land to use it for economic warfare purposes. In other words, it's agricultural land, and they have no intention of running any agriculture on it. As a matter of fact, they may be using it for wind farms, what have you, when the state, doesn't even have the authority to allow those things to happen. And so the people need to actually start making some real decisions of saying, this wind crap's got to go, this solar crap's got to go. It proves that it is not a dependable energy, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this way you actually take back the control of your state, and all of this land that has been basically leveraged away from you comes back to the hands of the state legislature. It would be my suggestion that the state legislature should try to open up and recreate indentured servitude. In other words, for immigration purposes in agricultural belts, people that want to come back to America and farm, family farm and do those types of things, if they come to the existing family farms, if maybe you've got a ranch or what have you, and you got a couple of ranch hands, and they're going to work for you for 7 years, without pay, you're just going to take care of them. And then when they do their 7 years, the state will award them, a parcel of land, 100 acres or whatever, so that they now have an opportunity to basically invest in, the equity and so forth. Now, indentured servitude, everybody's going to look at that and go, oh, so there may be something that financially creates some benefit so that, in other words, let's say that the ranch or the farm is because it's creating revenue for the state. The more work, the more productive the ranch or farm becomes, the more revenue for the state. Therefore, that revenue that the state is making should be able to possibly put that into a kitty and then not only kind of award these people a land bit, but be able to give them a very low interest rate in being able to fund the fundamentals of putting, a tent or a shack and, equipment to start farming, whatever that investment is. We need to start recognizing that everybody wants to live in a home that was built for Zuckerberg or Bill Gates. But it is very pretentious of a society to tell a person who is struggling to do everything they can to be self-sufficient for their family, to tell them that they can't live in an abode because we have higher standards for them than they do. In other words, we need to allow people to scrape. We need to allow people to, to rise up on their own, because when we create these false floors or ceilings in standards and so forth, whether that be labor, housing, these types of things, all we're doing is we're making it impossible for them to succeed. And we can't allow this to continue. We have to actually make America the land of opportunity again. And as nice and as noble as people think it is to give everybody air-conditioned homes with, you know, internet, all these things, I mean, it's one thing that the state government actually takes a real plan in providing, you know, high-quality internet for everybody. Because that right there is a huge boost in every home in their productivity. It's just like providing decent roads so that you can get commerce more efficiently through from the farm to the market or what have you. Infrastructure is important. I feel like I'm preaching, so I'll kind of stop myself here. The point is that there are lots of things that we need to discuss, but taking back the immigration, because I just had this conversation with a gentleman from Wyoming, and we were talking about how the states, if they actually controlled the immigration, they could dictate the type of people that they would be bringing in. And maybe the big resource that you have that you need to get back and breathing life into it again is agriculture. So why wouldn't you want to bring in farmers that would be willing to actually be a part of this homesteading, indentured servitude type of program where they come up here, they, you know, they work and then they send for their family after 7 years or whatever that is. Does that
Why
make
couldn't
sense?
We do that for people that are on welfare and social programs instead of bringing people from other countries?
So absolutely.
We have a lot of poor and disadvantaged people right here that are citizens.
So I agree. If there are people that want to migrate to Wyoming that live in the United States that want to deal with, because I don't know if there's, you know, Tammy, you know the lay of the land. What is the number one product, agricultural product, that isn't livestock? I mean, something that grows from the ground. What is the most yielding, what is the one thing that can grow in Wyoming that actually can make money because you guys have such a short growing season?
Sugar beets?
So one of the things I had heard was hemp. I had heard Bill Dolan basically say hemp will grow pretty good in Wyoming.
I don't know. I haven't heard that.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, but there's those types of things. But my point is that Wyoming may not be the ideal place for developing agriculture, what have you. But there may be other things, no. Ranching and those types of things. But I completely understand your point, Sean. And actually, we do need to open up those doors to allow everybody, not just immigrants, to come in. You're going to find, though, that there are going to be places that people will not want to go. They won't want to go into the hinterland. They won't want to be in the flyover states in America. Because
I'll take 40 acres and a mule any day.
You know what? There are some of those, but unfortunately, we have basically created a mollycoddled society. The kids, why do we have such, we have people that would rather live on the streets and stay high because they've been educated that we will continue to take care of them so that they can stay high. Our education system has created most all of our problems. And these folks don't even care about programs or opportunities to get away from those things. They don't. And unfortunately, it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, this is where a real mean part of me comes out. And it's not really mean. It's just pragmatic. I think it's the pragmatic way to help people understand is there's no more safety net. If you get yourself high and, you know, you need help, then, you know, if you come to the hospital, you either have to pay for that or we won't treat you again until you pay your bill. We'll deny you service. So don't go get high to where you overdose because you're going to die. Or, you know, you better have somebody close by that, you know, will keep you alive. We need to start, you know, stop enabling bad behavior. Because
I think that's the key to it is the enabling and facilitating.
Yes.
For the purpose of capturing society.
Right, right.
If you have people that have addictions or whatever trauma, you know, whatever they have, like we always talk about, the church is the place where that social welfare charity, you know what I mean? That kind of safety net. should be the community, not the government.
Right. And so, or the churches. The churches or communities, correct. Because both, it's almost the same thing, but I want to make sure that everybody understands, in American history, the entity that did the best in compassionate services, in other words, those who really cared and took care of people, were the churches more than anything else. This is why we had the best medical system in America, in the world. I mean, America had the best medical system in the world. And that's because if you look at our hospitals, they're called St. John, St. Joseph, Mount Sinai. I mean, they were all religious institutions. And did the churches make some money off of it? Yeah, but they weren't high profit like today. I mean, if you look at the health insurance companies who've been basically robbing and responsible for shutting down clinics across America, where now the only clinics that are being stood up are government supported. In other words, in Washington State, there are new clinics that are being stood up, but they are completely on the government dole, which means that they are moving us to a single-payer system. Folks, this is, we're at that transition point. I heard Senator Hawley in a recent, you know, conference with some people. I don't know if they were working with him or what have you. He was throwing this out. Why don't we give a 100% tax break on any dollar that somebody spends on their health care? If health care is unaffordable, then we need to, every dollar that they spend, they get a complete tax break. And as far as I'm concerned, Senator Hawley, pull your head out your butt. You have no authority to be actually managing our healthcare system. Why are you advocating the dismantling of the healthcare system instead of maintaining the tyranny over it? That's the difference between...
Go ahead. I was going to say that goes to the Uniparty. That's how the Uniparty gets their leverage over people, because you have the extreme and the fringes who are talking about the government paying for everybody's healthcare.
Yes.
And instead of, like you're saying, no, the government shouldn't be paying for any health care. Right. It shouldn't be involved in health care.
Right.
They go, oh, well, we'll give you a tax break. How about that?
Right.
Instead of doing that, we'll run it a different way. But it's still the same premise.
Yes.
They're running health care. Yes. They shouldn't be.
Okay. So what I was going to say was something exactly the same but different. This is the difference between conservative and progressive. They're two sides of the same coin. It's conservative and a moral management of unconstitutional government, or an immoral, tyrannical management of an unconstitutional government. The constitutional view is, do you have the authority to manage it? If you don't, then let it go and deregulate it and get it back to where it needs to be, back into the communities, back into the churches, and so forth. Get your hands off of these things that you have no authority, because states, the only reason states created laws regarding healthcare and medical systems, if you look at your constitution when they were amended and so forth, it all came from the federal government. And many of these things weren't really constitutional amendments. They were just injections because, oh, the federal government mandated we do this.
Right.
Anyway.
And all written by the insurance and profit-based companies involved in the healthcare industry.
Yeah, okay. So with that, we've got 42 seconds left. Tammy, go. I'm sorry. I know you haven't been included in this, and I know you've probably been chomping at the bit. And so with 30 seconds left, I wanted to let everybody know, when we come back, I'll let you have the final say before we get into Resolution 7. And when we come back, we'll hear what you have to say, you know, give you the final word, and then we'll dive into Resolution 7. Is that fair?
Good.
Okay, good. I want to make sure that, you know everybody, because I the whole point of having a table of discussion is putting ideas on it. And if only one person is putting the ideas on, then, boy, we don't have very much depth. So the better the depth, the better the ideas, nine times the better the innovation, the better the solutions, and so forth. Because having other views, and I think this goes back to the same thing with the Constitutional Convention. As these men were working together, I think the spirit was able to inspire them and work in ways that they could not have done on their own. Anyway, with that, we'll let this break go. We'll be right back in just a minute. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so the floor is Tammy's. And go ahead.
Well, I think I probably speak for other people as well, but I'm just left completely confused as to what exactly the federal government's responsibility is with immigration and is not.
Go ahead. Keep going.
I just need to go through and study all of this again because, you know, people are so used to the federal government. They're so used to the idea that they are supreme over the states that it's just really confusing to me right now.
Yeah, I know. And so just think, if the federal government didn't steal control over energy, where would we be as a nation energy-wise? We would probably have been far more innovative. And we would probably not be dealing with the toxic types of energy systems, but that's a topic for another day, and it's actually will probably never be a main topic for this show, because I think that when we get into some of those types of technologies and some of those types of discussions, they become ultra dangerous, because when one actually looks at the amount of money in just the energy sector, the trillions of dollars involved in the consumption. Now, this is consumption. Burning. It's just, this goes away. It's like burning money. That there's so much money going into it because by scarcity, it increases their profits. Oh, the less we have, that means the supply is less and the demand is higher. So we can raise our prices. The last thing they want to do is all of a sudden see the demand go away. As a matter of fact, I look forward to the day when America can tell all these oil-producing countries, not that I think oil is bad, I think we should be able to maintain oil in the cars or whatever you want to run, petroleum, however you want to do it, you do it the way you want to do it. But I believe that if we give people a better solution, they're going to gravitate towards that. And it's not going to be some crappy solution. I'm talking about cheaper, where they have more disposable income instead of spending this outrageous amount of money we spend on energy today. I'm talking about getting your electrical bill down to $20, $30 a month. I'm talking about getting energy is so affordable that now you actually have the ability to start bolstering your own home industries or whatever you want to do, instead of allowing corporations to steal every last penny out of your pocket to where you can barely get by. Because if you look at how much people spend on energy alone, it's added into your cost of your food. If energy is hardly negligible, then your food prices will go down. If energy is hardly a cost at all for your home, then your home operation costs will go down. If your car, if let's say it's free, let's say you don't have to buy at the pump anymore, you can create your own. I just sound like a madman, but my point is that if you add up what you spend on your car, you know, the maintenance of the car, what have you, for the petroleum, because on the petroleum side it causes exhaust problems, intake problems, and so forth. The point is this, is that we're talking probably $1,000 a month most families are spending on their energy costs folded into their food or what have you. I think anybody that looks at their budget and says, wow, you know, if I see that the cost of food, that maybe 20% or 10% of that is energy. And, you know, bringing that in maintaining the fills, maintaining the cows, what have you, there's got to be an added cost for the energy side. So when we add all of these things up, you go, wow, $1,000 a month, that's a lot of money that's being taken out of your pocket just for one sector. There's that much money in it. So the point is that I think when we actually look at actually coming up with solutions, then and when all ideas reach the table, and especially if the ideas reach the table at the lower levels, it's harder to bury because it actually proliferates very quickly. When you do it in star chambers, nobody knows. Nobody knows what deals were, you know, killed. Ideas that never made it out. I do know, and I remember, you know, in the old fairs, the old science fairs and so forth, state fairs, and as a matter of fact, there used to be a world fair. I think Louisiana had the world fair, didn't it? Didn't New Orleans? The Kingdome was, or not the Kingdome, the Superdome or whatever, that was a part of the world fair that came to New Orleans, right?
The Superdome wasn't part of it.
Okay.
But, yeah, we had the World's Fair in 84.
Okay.
And they did some, like, renovations and refurbishing to areas of the warehouse district that we used to have.
Right, yeah. So we had the World Fair in Washington, I think, once or twice in the 60s and 70s. And in those fairs, you'd actually see alternative ideas. And I remember seeing an idea that a car would run on water. Or, you know, electricity, these other ideas. But then you go, well, wow, whatever happened to those ideas? Those, they get bought up. The oil companies come along and go, man, we can't have that. So my point... Go ahead.
Disappear.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was saying the inventors disappear. There's a recent story about a guy who's in the military who actually built a car that ran on water. And when he was trying to get the patent and kind of pushing the issue... In the government arena, he came to an not so good end.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. And I used to subscribe to the idea back in the 90s that the only place where we could actually develop that type of challenging technology and paradigm would be someplace like North Korea, where everything would be done in secret until they were ready to launch this huge shift that would, you know, literally change everything for the and attack the globalists and everything else. But then, you know, the reality sets in that the globalists have full control over Korea. They would know about it. They would kill you right there, and you would never be heard of ever again.
That's their laboratory.
Yeah. So anyway, let's dive into these Kentucky resolutions, because as we dive into these, this literally helps us understand the Constitution in a framework that nobody talks about. As a matter of fact, when most people look at this, they're only looking for the nullification words. They're not looking at all of these other things that when we take it into full context, all of these little ideas or these points that Jefferson's making regarding the presidential powers over the judiciary, instead of the judiciary, and so forth and so on, from immigration, the importation, the rights, the individual rights, and so forth. He's making points that is completely lost to America today. Completely lost. This is why we go through the Constitution on this show in depth. We read it in depth until we've covered it to ad nauseum. So this seventh resolution is kind of laying out again this general focus, because in Resolution 8, this is setting the stage for Resolution 8, where Jefferson basically says, now here is how we're going to attack this. So, Sean, since it's your turn, let's go ahead and dive into Resolution 8. Go ahead.
All righty, sir. Resolution 8.
Sean, I'm sorry.
Yes.
It builds to Resolution 8. My bad. I should have gotten back to, let's do Resolution 7, because that's what we need to cover to set the stage. So go ahead. I'm all sorry. Right, thank you so much.
Resolved that the construction applied by the general government, as is evidenced by the sundry of their proceedings, to those parts of the Constitution of the United States which delegate to Congress a power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imports, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, and to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof, goes to the destruction of all limits prescribed to their powers by the Constitution. That words meant by the instrument to be subsidiary only to the execution of limited powers ought not to be so construed as themselves to give unlimited powers, nor part to be so taken as to destroy the whole residue of that instrument. That the proceedings of the general government under color of these articles will be a fit and necessary subject of revisal and correction at a time of greater tranquility, while those specified in the preceding resolutions call for immediate redress.
Okay, so he's basically laying out this idea that they have the power to lay, you know, taxes and so forth. In other words, that general clause at the beginning of Article 1, Section 8, the preamble to the powers. And then he adds to that at the very end, and be able to create all laws necessary and proper for the carrying of forward, or carrying out the execution of those foregoing powers. And so as we, you know, as he ties those things together, he basically says that if they can actually start assuming these types of powers, then what would end up happening would go to the destruction of all limits prescribed to their powers by the Constitution. Big flag right there in the middle of that. Goes to the destruction of all limits prescribed to their powers when they have the ability to just make it up as they go along. We're seeing this today. As a matter of fact, there is arguments by sovereign citizens and general assemblists out there that are trying to prove to people that this government is not legitimate and that the Constitution is not legitimate because the Constitution is letting them do these things, that we need to dismantle the Constitution and this government and restore a new government and a new Constitution. That is a huge, dangerous proposition, and it is an insurrectionist idea. And what we call these people, these people are amongst the patriots. In other words, they're almost as just as bad as the communists in the leftist category, because they're demanding a complete dismantling as well. This is the conservative side to say, they're so far into a monarchical theocracy, into this conservative vein of thinking we have to have a biblical constitution, when this constitution supersedes that, because the biblical is literally something that has been contrived and contrived and contrived. I mean, Sean, Tammy, how many Bibles are there today that have their own language or their own vernacular? They use different scriptures, but overall, the Bible of the history, the Old Testament, New Testament Bible, how many different versions are there?
Many.
Many.
So many.
Many. Hundreds. So the beautiful thing about our Constitution is we allow that diversity to exist. What these people want to do is they want to take away the diversity and the liberty of being able to live your conscience, which is integral to this Constitution. The reality is the things that our government is doing, they're doing without the authority. We still have a legitimate Constitution. We still have a legitimate government. It is acting on many illegitimate powers. They're still doing some things legitimately, believe it or not, just a few. But they're still doing them. And, you know, as people say, oh, well, you look at, you know, when they brought these new states in, these new states were brought in, you know, under these new auspices. Well, hold on here. Under the Constitution, they had the authority to bring in states. They may have changed unconstitutionally the status or the positions that these states came in. They had no authority to do that. but they still had the authority to bring in states. So don't tell me that these states are all doomed, that they're all illegitimate. It's just the things that were basically applied to them or restricted to them or, you know, inflicted upon them, that was illegitimate. Don't start confusing.
Terms.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying the violation of the terms of the contract.
Yes.
The contract is still valid. They're just violating it.
Yes. Okay, so, and there you have it. Because bottom line, that is the huge, I'll just say that's the huge deception that these organizations are creating. They're trying to get you to believe that everything about our government, the Constitution, everything is the problem. And I deal with these guys all the time. And I'm starting to poke them in the eye because I'm tired of their propaganda. They're having an ill effect because we're getting people to literally turn their back on what they're supposed to be defending. And I poke these guys in the eye and say, your responsibility is to defend and support that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, not the government, not these unconstitutional vestiges and powers and so forth. Your job is to demand the compliance of the Constitution as a citizen, and you're actually abjugating your responsibility and you're turning your back. You're just as bad as the progressives and the communists. And they don't like that. Oh, boy, that really gets under their skin. But the truth hurts, right? And anyway, so let's dive into Resolution 8. Now, there may be this GA above and so forth that has a separation, but what I want to do is I want to actually read this very first part in blue, and then we'll pick up the to assure after that, Tammy, because what Jefferson is doing right here created literally a panic and caused feedback that really insulted Jefferson. So go ahead, right here.
Resolve that a committee of conference and correspondence be appointed who shall have in charge to communicate the preceding resolutions to the legislatures of the several states.
So what Jefferson basically did is we're setting up, Kentucky's setting up a committee of conference and correspondence and to be appointed. And then the whole point was basically when this gets done, it's basically saying you need to do this too. And down the road here, he basically says we expect to, you know, to cooperate and work with you. And when we get to Madison's resolution of 1798, you'll see that they're basically responding in kind, saying we agree with you and we're on board. We're here to defend the Constitution and attack the enemies thereof. So go ahead with this next part. And if you notice that there's some red towards the bottom, we can stop at the end of the unhighlighted red at that semicolon. And as a matter of fact, I think you recognize this because it was you that commented that this is one long sentence.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I believe this resolution might be one or two sentences. And as I look at it in a spanning of a page, it easily goes beyond a page. It easily goes beyond a page. It's almost 2 pages. Go ahead.
A couple of pages. Okay. To assure them that this Commonwealth continues in the same esteem of their friendship and union, which it has manifested from that moment at which a common danger first suggested a common union, that it considers union for specified national purposes, and particularly to those specified in their late federal compact, to be friendly to the peace, happiness, and prosperity of all the states, that faithful to that compact, according to the plain intent and meaning in which it was understood and acceded to by the several parties, it is sincerely anxious for its preservation, that it does also believe that to take from the states all the powers of self-government and transfer them to a general and consolidated government without regard to the special delegations and reservations solemnly agreed to in that compact is not for the peace, happiness, or prosperity of these states.
Okay. So here he starts off with the calling for the committees, and then he wants to assure them that this Commonwealth continues in its same esteem of their friendship and union. And then he goes on to say that we considered, again, this union for this national purpose, you know, to create this warm tranquility and, you know, this happy pursuit of happiness, right? This pursuit of happiness. And then he dives in into this red underline stuff where he basically says, hey, they're going down this path that basically denies what we acceded to, what we all agreed to as parties to the compact, that they were going to be tied or they were going to be limited to only doing these things. And now they're doing things that are literally antithetical, opposing those principles. And therefore, what we're looking at is we're not looking anymore at a union of peace or happiness or prosperity. Okay, so he's kind of, you know, you can see how he's building this stage. And this is a long argument. And, you know, Jefferson, very powerful man in, you know, instigating and getting people, you know, their blood boiling. I mean, he was the guy, before the Constitution was ratified, he was the guy that basically said the blood of liberty needs to be needs to refresh the tree of tyranny every 20 years, something like that, a comment of his. After the Constitution was ratified and after he became a part of the government in the operation of this Constitution, he became pretty profoundly smart on it. Prior to that, there was some things missing. He was out of country. He was only reading the text and didn't have the ratification debates and all these other things to help illuminate him. But once he got to this point of 1798, where is his comment that the tree of liberty, the roots of the tree of liberty need to be refreshed with blood every 20 years? See, he's not calling for that. Jefferson had literally changed by this Constitution. He saw that the opportunities under this Constitution, with the parties being the states to the compact, the way this thing was designed, with very limited powers, he got it. He realized we don't have to fight a revolution. We have the authority to force compliance. A beautiful thing. So he goes on now, and he builds even more into this next highlighted section. So go ahead and read this whole paragraph where it ends with exercised under it, where I kind of put an unnatural paragraph break there. But go ahead and read that part now. Okay. Go ahead.
And that therefore this Commonwealth is determined, as it doubts not its co-states are, to submit to unregulated and consequently unlimited powers in no man or body of men on earth, that in cases of an abuse of the delegated powers, the members of the general government being chosen by the people, a change by the people would be the constitutional remedy, but where powers are assumed which have not been delegated, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. That every state has a natural right in cases not within the compact to nullify their own authority, all assumptions of power by others within their limits, that without this right, they would be under the domination, absolute and unlimited, of whosoever might exercise this right of judgment for them, that nevertheless, this Commonwealth, from motives of regard and respect for its co-states, has wished to communicate with them on the subject, that with them alone it is proper to communicate, they alone being parties to the compact, and solely authorized to judge in the last resort of the powers exercised under it.
Okay. So he uses this.
The whole point of everything that we're doing, this whole paragraph.
Yes. So.
That's what I was going to say.
So, but he uses this term nullify. Now, when we hear, and he says this, and there are so many people that repeat this, that I've gotten to a point where I kind of laugh at people. Because people say, well, the law is in violation to the Constitution, so it's nullified and void. On its own, it's just nullified and void. Well, hold on here. What if the law was intentionally done where they knew that they didn't have the authority and they did it because they knew they had the control over it? So how does it become nullified and void as you're making this assertion? Right? So does somebody really believe that the paper will recognize the ink that is in violation and it will just naturally expunge it by making it disappear? Is there that kind of magic that makes laws nullify and void? What happened? That law doesn't exist anymore. It's not on paper. We got to rewrite it. And every time they write it, it just disappears. Well, obviously we can't have that law. That magic doesn't exist. There is a process of nullification. Nullification cannot be done by an entity that is not the entity that created it. In this particular case, the federal government created a law. They created four acts, four laws. And in those four laws, they overreached, and each of those laws, as Jefferson had proven, were violation, and they should be void. But they don't become void until one of two things. If you nullify the act as a state has the right to nullify that act. But if they do it, and the other states aren't equally demanding nullification, in other words, the expunging of the law, then if that state chooses to nullify, they must leave the union. But he doesn't say this here, because his intent isn't to leave the union. His intent is to force the Congress to nullify the law, because only they can do it. Now, in going through the Constitution, we kind of pointed out that the Congress, our legislatures, are our sovereigns. I don't think many people recognize what I say when I say that. They can inflict upon us a hurt beyond any imagination. The only thing that keeps them from doing that legitimately is this Constitution and its limited powers. But if we go down this path, as Thomas Jefferson said, and actually I love quoting it, but so I probably want to pull it up. And so let me see here. I will pull it up, because I've got it in one of my articles coming forward that we look at. Where is it? Cotton picking. No, it's not there. Well, okay, so it's ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. I'm just going to try to paraphrase it. Ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country, because if you are ignorant of the law, then they can pretend the law upon you. And that's what we have today. Because we don't know what they can't do, they're doing it to us. Because of our illiteracy, because of our ignorance of the Constitution, they're doing everything they want to us. It started with the best of intentions. And what ended up happening is reality set in, and they go, hey, nobody noticed. Nobody did anything. You know, when the resistance stopped, when the framers died off, they started getting away with murder. But it became gradual. I mean, they weren't really killing people like they are today. And so when we come back, we'll be picking this back up with Resolution 8. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And I'm hoping you're recognizing the value in going through these documents and giving you a view of the Constitution you've never, ever thought of before.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.